ebooks.
Hello and welcome back to Epochs. And if you remember, we were talking all about the life and times and adventures of Constantine the First, Constantine the Great. So we're in the early 300s, the early 4th century AD, and the Roman world breaking apart and, well, coming back together, at least for a while. We've had the crisis of the 3rd century, haven't we? Where there was sort of an endless string of more or less military emperors keep usurping one another, one after the other after the other, their men proclaiming them emperor, and just an endless stream of civil wars and barbarian incursions and economic crises. All of that came to an end with Diocletian, who was a super strong emperor, super, super strong. He was able to unite the Roman world once more under one strong reign. But he had decided, hadn't he, crucially, that he was going to change the game, he was going to change the nature of Roman government entirely, fundamentally, from a principate, so-called principate, to a dominate. And the Tetrarchy wanted to, decided there should be four emperors, two senior Augusti and two junior Caesars, four emperors ruling the Roman world because it was so big. And there were so many barbarian incursions all the time. They would need four Johnny on the spots. One emperor is just not enough. And the idea is that that Tetrarchy, that rule of four, would have to be entirely all on the same page at the same time. That was the idea, that their government, their policy, was a thing of unison. They must all be singing from the same hymn sheet, so to speak. Well, it was all well and good while he lived, Diocletian lived. Again, I've said it before, haven't I, about how it's a bit like Bismarck, Otto von Bismarck's delicate system of government. It worked whilst he was in control of it, because he made it. It was a brainchild of his, and it was idiosyncratic. And yeah, delicate, and it worked while he was at the helm, but as soon as he wasn't, likely to fall apart. Well, same with Diocletian's Tetrarchy. Diocletian and Maximian, his co-emperor, his first co-emperor, are now out of the picture. He's retired, and Diocletian's retired, Maximian is dead. Last time, if you remember, we were talking about, at one point, there were six emperors. There were six emperors. In the west, there was Constantine, who had taken over from his father, Constantius. There was Maximian, the old Maximian, who'd come out of retirement, Diocletian's co-emperor, and his son, Maxentius, sort of a double act in a way, although they didn't see eye to eye. So three emperors in the west, there should only be two. And then in the east, you've got Galerius, who's supposed to be the most senior of all of them. He's supposed to be the new Diocletian, if you like. You've got him, and then you've got Licinius and Maximin in the east. So there's six emperors at one point. But okay, Galerius had died of natural causes, and Constantine had been forced to execute Maximian for trying a coup against him, against Constantine. So we're down to four again. So we're down to four. Okay, that's basically where we left the story off last time. So let's pick up the story. As always, for this series, I'm going to be reading from Edward Gibbon, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, his seminal work. So let's let Gibbon pick up the story right about there. He says this, quote, "Among so many crimes and misfortunes occasioned by the passions of the Roman princes, or these emperors, there is some pleasure in discovering a single action which may be ascribed to their virtue. In the sixth year of his reign, Constantine visited the city of Utan and generously remitted the arrears of tribute, reduced at the same time the proportion of their assessment from 25 to 18,000 heads, subject to the real and personal capitation. Yet even this indulgence affords the most unquestionable proof of the public misery. This tax was so extremely oppressive, either in itself or in the mode of collecting it, that, whilst the revenue was increased by extortion, it was diminished by despair." Yeah, we've said before, haven't we, that all through this period, all through the crisis of the 3rd century and the reign of Diocletian, and now onwards into this period, the taxation that fell upon the Roman world, whether you're an actual Roman citizen or not, the level of taxation was going up and up and up. Incidentally, it's not as much as we pay in taxes these days, crazily. But still, they considered it truly extortionate and way over the top, and it just caused misery and penury. I mean, at least in this day and age, if you really, really can't afford to pay tax, if you have no money, the state doesn't still insist you pay up. So there's a very, very different type of taxation. But okay, It caused despair and, well, civil unrest, a great deal of anger. Gibbon goes on saying, a considerable part of the territory of Aten was left uncultivated. The great numbers of the provincials rather chose to live as exiles and outlaws than to support the weight of civil society, i.e. they'd risk execution rather than pay taxes. It is but too probable that the bountiful emperor relieved by a partial act of liberality one among the many evils which he had caused by his general maxims of administration. But even those maxims were less the effect of choice than of necessity. And if we accept the death of Maximian, the reign of Constantine in Gaul seems to have been the most innocent and even virtuous period of his life. The provinces were protected by his presence from the inroads of the barbarians, from across the Rhine largely, who either dreaded or experienced his active valour. After a signal victory over the Franks and the Alemanni, several of their princes were exposed by his order to the wild beasts in the amphitheatre at Trèves, and the people seem to have enjoyed the spectacle without discovering in such a treatment of royal captives anything that was repugnant to the laws of nations or of humanity. It's still only the very, very early 4th century. The idea that you would watch executions, even extremely brutal, almost cruel and unusual ones, being torn apart by beasts. Yeah, that's not uncommon. It's not outside the pale. It's the early 300s here we're talking about. Okay, Gibbon goes on saying, the virtues of Constantine were rendered more illustrious by the vices of Maxentius. You remember, there's only two emperors in the West now, Constantine and Maxentius, who was the son of Maximian, is ruled in Rome, and he wasn't even one of Galerius's picks. He sort of usurped, took power in Italy and Rome. And so there's now only him and Constantine surviving in the West. And Gibbon's saying that Constantine is made to look even better than he is because of how bad Maxentius was. Just a quick note to say here, is all of this exactly true and accurate? Or is it that, as we know, don't we, and it's not a spoiler alert, that in the end, Constantine wins. He's not Constantine the Great for nothing. He doesn't tower over. He's not a household name even to this day for no good reason. Is it because he wins and he gets to rewrite all the histories, really, mostly? That he would write that all his enemies along the road, all his enemies during his long journey to sole power, were bad and evil. So bear that in mind. Bear all of that in mind. We don't know, right? The early 4th century is so long ago to us, and the literary evidence is relatively scant that we just don't know the exact truth on that count. But okay, Gibbon has done all the reading, literally all the reading, so let him tell us the story. He says this. Whilst the Gallic provinces, Gaul that is, enjoyed as much happiness as the condition of the times were capable of receiving, Italy and Africa groaned under the dominion of a tyrant as contemptible as he was odious. Let's talk about Maxentius there. And remember, Africa just really means the North African coastline, not much more than that. It's just North Africa they're talking about. The zeal of flattery and faction has indeed too frequently sacrificed the reputation of the vanquished to the glory of their successful rivals, which is what we were talking about. Can we really trust the accounts that Maxentius was as bad as he was when it becomes politically important for Constantine to paint him that way? But okay, Gibbon goes on saying, but even those writers who had revealed with the most freedom and pleasure the faults of Constantine unanimously confessed that Maxentius was cruel, rapacious, and profligate. He had the good fortune to suppress a slight rebellion in Africa. The governor and a few adherents had been guilty. The province suffered for their crime. The flourishing cities of Cirthra and Carthage and the whole extent of the fertile country were wasted by fire and sword. The abuse of victory was followed by the abuse of law and justice. A formidable army of sycophants and delators invaded Africa. The rich and the noble were easily convicted on a connection with the rebels. And those among them who experienced their emperor's clemency were only punished by the confiscation of their estates. So signal a victory was celebrated by a magnificent triumph, and Maxentius exposed to the eyes of the people the spoils and captives of a Roman province. The capital was no less deserving of compassion than that of Africa. The wealth of Rome supplied an inexhaustible fund for his vain and prodigal expenses, and the ministers of his revenue were skilled in the art of rapine. That's saying that Maxentius lived in a sort of an extremely rich, opulent style. And if he needed his men, his ministers, his soldiers, to steal the wealth of the people, whether it be from Romans, Italians, North Africans, then he just did it. It was one of those types of rulers where nothing, absolutely nothing, should get in the way of him enjoying himself, even if it's to almost an insane degree. Many such examples, like Nero or Commodus, many, many, many examples. Gibbon goes on saying, it was under his reign that the method of exacting, quote, a free gift, quote, from the senators was first invented. And as the sum was insensibly increased, the pretenses of levying it, a victory, a birth, a marriage, or an imperial consulship, were proportionably multiplied. So this is a classic example of a ruler saying, oh, there's, you know, exactly as Gibbon said, oh, there's been a birth or a marriage in the royal family, so all the rich people, the senators, you've got to give me a big chunk of your money now. Not just a bit of money, a big chunk of your entire wealth now. And something else has happened, something of note has happened, so in the end you can just start making it up exactly the way Nero did, or Domitian or Commodus. Just say, ah, it's actually suddenly I've remembered it's a really auspicious day for Jupiter today, isn't it? Or Saturn. Something's happened and Saturn is displeased or very happy or whatever. You can just make anything up. And now you've got to give me loads of money. It's quite simple. Now, that sort of thing usually doesn't go down very well. It won't last long. You'll get yourself assassinated or murdered if you keep doing that. Only princes, only rulers of whatever stripe, whose power and power base is extremely secure, can get away with that sort of behaviour for very long, certainly in the ancient and medieval world. Gibbon goes on saying, Maxentius had imbibed the same implacable aversion to the Senate which had characterised most of the former tyrants of Rome, nor was it possible for his ungrateful temper to forgive the generous fidelity which had raised him to the throne and supported him against all his enemies. Because remember, he was a usurper himself. He only came to power through the goodwill of the Praetorian Guard, the Senate of Rome. It seems like some sort of popular support in Rome and even wider Italy. So you might think that he would maybe on one level be their puppet, on another level at least be generous and kind to them, at least be a bit like Augustus and pretend you're being kind and generous to them, pretend you respect them, at least that. No. Maxentius is just acting like a full-blown tyrant. I mean, Gibbon there's called it ungrateful, his ungrateful temper. Well, it's a bit more than ungrateful, isn't it? It's taking the absolute mickey, I would say. But okay, let's read on. The lives of the senators were exposed to his jealous suspicions. The dishonour of their wives and daughters heightened the gratification of his sensual passions. I think you all know what is being said there. It may be presumed that an imperial lover was seldom reduced to sire in vain, but whenever persuasion proved ineffectual, he had recourse to violence. A rapist. He's calling him a rapist there. In fact, a serial rapist. And there remains one memorable example of a noble matron who preserved her chastity by a voluntary death, rather commit suicide than give in to Maxentius's advances. The soldiers were the only order of men whom he appeared to respect or studied to please. He filled Rome and Italy with armed troops, connived at their tumults, suffered them with impunity to plunder and even to massacre the defenceless people, and indulged them in the same licentiousness which their emperor enjoyed. Again, rape we're talking about here. So rape and murder and rapine and pillage and all these sorts of things. So Maxentius is showing himself, if you believe the accounts that passed through the filter of Constantine's camp at some point, if you believe it, he's just a really, really bad military dictator, nothing more than an evil, baddie military dictator. Okay. Maxentius often bestowed on his military favourites the splendid villa or the beautiful wife of a senator. A prince of such a character, alike incapable of governing either in peace or in war, might purchase the support, but could never obtain the esteem of the army. So the army that he needs for his power base is his power base. He may be able to pay for them, but they will never truly love him, truly love him, the way, according to accounts, the men loved Marius or Caesar, because he's just too much of a douchebag. He's too evil. Okay, Gibbon goes on saying this, quote, "Yet his pride was equal to his other vices. Whilst he passed his indolent life, either within the walls of his palace or in the neighbouring gardens of Sallust," this is in Rome itself, "he was repeatedly heard to declare that he alone was emperor, and that the other princes were no more than his lieutenants, on whom he had devolved the defence of the frontier provinces, and that he might enjoy without interruption the elegant luxury of the capital. Rome, which had so long regretted the absence, lamented during the 6 years of his reign the presence of her sovereign," end quote. So now Maxentius, again, if you believe the accounts, he's actually trying to claim he's the most senior now of the four remaining emperors. He's not, is he? He can't be. Surely not. You would think if you had to pick one of them, the only one that's like legit, if you like, in the sense of like the Diocletian form of government, would be Licinius. Surely Licinius in the East would be the senior one. But okay. Maxentius is claiming he is he alone was emperor, Gibbon says. Well, first and foremost, is Constantine gonna like that? Is Constantine gonna put up with that forever? What if Maxentius starts to try and tell Constantine what to do, let alone the other emperors in the East? Constantine's the sort of man that would put up with that. And remember, Maxentius's father had tried to usurp Constantine. Do you think Constantine's going to forget that? Remember also, though, Constantine is married to Maxentius's sister, Maximian's daughter. But we were told, weren't we, last time, that she, when it came to any sort of crunch moment, she would always side with her husband, Constantine, in any sort of decision like that. So it's not really worth that much necessarily that his wife, you know, Maxentius is his brother-in-law, but still, bear it in mind. So Gibbon continues, flipping back to Constantine. We're told this, "Though Constantine might view the conduct of Maxentius with abhorrence and the situation of the Romans with compassion, we have no reason to presume that he would have taken up arms to punish the one or to relieve the other. But the tyrant of Italy," that is Maxentius, "rashly ventured to provoke a formidable enemy whose ambition had been hitherto restrained by considerations of prudence rather than by principles of justice. After the death of Maximian, his titles, according to the established custom, had been erased and his statues thrown down with ignominy. His son," Maxentius again, we're talking about here, "who had persecuted and deserted him when alive, affected to display the most pious regard for his memory and gave orders that a similar treatment should be immediately inflicted on all the statues that had been erected in Italy and Africa to the honour of Constantine." Uh-oh. Okay, this is bad. In the early 4th century, that's bad. Well, in all of the ancient world, really. Like statue wars, if you like. Pretty much the whole, well, even to, say, the ancient world, even to this day, there's battles, in a sense, aren't there, over statues, over which statues get pulled down, over which statues get put up. Well, in the ancient world, it was a far, far bigger deal. If you pulled down all the statues of a certain person, your political enemy, that was much, much more than an insult. That's almost, really, almost a declaration of war. That's kind of like a line in the sand, a third rail, however you want to put it. It's not quite, you know, it's not really a formal declaration of war, but it's bloody close. It's signalling that you hate that person, you despise that person. You would annihilate that person if you could. That's what it says. And that's what Max just done to all Constantine's statues in Italy and North Africa. Okay, Gibbon goes on saying, "That wise prince, Constantine, who sincerely wished to decline a war, with the difficulty and importance of which he was sufficiently acquainted, at first dissembled the insult, pretended not to notice the insult, and sought for redress by the milder expedients of negotiation, till he was convinced that the hostile and ambitious designs of the Italian emperor made it necessary for him to arm in his own defence." So again, do you believe all of this exactly played out exactly like this? That Constantine was the 100% aggrieved party at all times, and Maxentius is just like an evil, murdering, rapist tyrant, or once again, has it all passed through the lens of the later period of Constantine's absolute power, and so he's going to have the history rewritten in his favour. Maxentius, who openly avowed his pretensions to the whole monarchy of the West, had already prepared a very considerable force to invade the Gallic provinces on the side of Rhaetia. And though he could not expect any assistance from Licinius, he was flattered with the hope that the legions of Illyricum, allured by his presence and promises, would desert the standard of that prince and unanimously declare themselves his soldiers and subjects. Constantine no longer hesitated. He had deliberated with caution. He now acted with vigour. Again, do you remember last time I talked about how one of the things Constantine did, one of the things Constantine was very good at, is a quick march, right? Great generals throughout all of history, certainly pre-modern history, the great ones were always great at this, right? Alexander, Caesar, Julian the Apostate, Napoleon, all the greats. They will turn up somewhere where they're not expected with an army ready to rock and roll. And whoever you are, you're not ready for that. And that's basically the ball game right there. Constantine was one of those guys that was good at doing this. And remember, Constantine was a military man first and foremost. Remember when we talked about how we read Gibbon's passages about Constantine's early life, that he was raised basically in the camp, certainly from his sort of teenage years and all through his being a young man, all through his 20s, he was in the army. He was a military man, he's a military tribune. His whole life. He's a soldier, really. He's steeped in the military camp. So when it comes to a clash of arms, if there is to be battles, Constantine's got the upper hand because he does really know what he's doing. And not just know what he's doing, but is actually very, very good, right? It's one thing to have been raised as a military person, but it doesn't necessarily translate into you being a great general, like a really good general. It doesn't necessarily mean that at all. But Constantine was, well, if you believe the accounts, but we definitely know that he won lots and lots and lots and lots of battles, and you don't do that by accident, right? You can win a few battles by accident, have a fluke run, but you can't really go undefeated or nearly undefeated for a whole lifetime and it not be because you're genuinely skilled. We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.